Welcome to the Giants Huddle.
Get him in the huddle.
A New York Giants podcast.
I'm John Schmelk, and welcome to another episode of the Giants Huddle podcast. We'll get to our guest, George Sharruri, one of the great data scientists over at Pro Football Focus, to talk some analytics in just a moment. But first, I want to remind you folks out there, if you're listening to this podcast on Giants.com or the Giants mobile app, we appreciate it. But go to your favorite podcast platform, whatever it might be. Subscribe. Leave a positive review if you're on iTunes or Apple Podcast, and those numbers will go up, and it'll make this podcast bigger and better than ever. So enough with that. Let's get to our guest, and I've been practicing this for a year, so I'm going to try it again. His name is George Sharruri, and he's one of the data scientists over at Pro Football Focus. George, did I get the little emphasis there on the middle correct?
I've got to say, I've heard some real bad renditions in my life. But that one, that might be the best that I've heard.
Seriously?
That is really well done. That you clearly put in the work. That was something to behold right there. That's about as good as I think I can say it, because you really have to have sort of grown up speaking Arabic to fully like know how to say it. I did not. So well done.
I will credit my diverse Brooklyn, New York roots for being able to do that. All right, George, let's start with Giants-specific stuff first before we get into some of the general analytics stuff you guys are doing over there, which I think is really interesting. We know what you guys generally think about the running game, and you can kind of, you know, talk about that in your answer to this specific question on the Giants. What's the best way in the modern NFL for an NFL team to utilize a running back like Saquon Barkley?
That's a great question. I think that's a question that a lot of teams should be asking themselves, particularly ones that have drafted running backs in the first round. One of the ways that I kind of look at this is, what are the running backs that have been the most valuable over the past few seasons? And those have been guys like David Johnson 3 seasons ago, where he was getting downfield in the receiving game, because that's where the individual talents and ability of the running backs are the most valuable, right? The running game is so much about running in the right situation. I'm sure we'll get into this a little bit later, how good your run blocking is, all those things. But in the passing game, right, the receiver has to be able to collect targets downfield. That is what generates value in the NFL. And so that's exactly what Saquon would be best off doing. The issue, I think, and when we look back last season, was that really didn't happen. He managed through volume and sheer talent and ability to climb into that top five in terms of value among running backs using our wins above replacement model. But there were some real inefficiencies to his game, and I'll explain it this way. So I looked at the running backs that have 100-plus targets, and I looked at their average depth of target. In other words, how far downfield on average were they being targeted? And Saquon is just barely past the line of scrimmage, where guys like Christian McCaffrey, Alvin Kamara, David Johnson, as I mentioned from a couple of years ago, were getting 2, 3, 4 yards downfield on average per target. And that is one of the biggest predictors, if not the biggest predictor, for whether a target is going to be successful, whether it's going to generate value. To kind of double down on that, another way to think about it is you're trying to gain first downs, right? So I can look at how far behind the first down marker you're being targeted. Essentially, how much work does the receiver have to do after just getting open and making the catch to make a first down? And Saquon Barkley, by far of that group of top five running backs, targeted the furthest behind the line to gain, almost 10 yards on average. So for him to just come close to generating value, he's got to be Herculean. Now, the cool thing is that Saquon is remarkably good, but you're just not giving him a chance to generate value by forcing him to do things that no human could possibly be able to do, which is to gain 10 yards after getting open and catching the ball at the NFL level. It's just a really tough thing to do. So one of the ways that I would think about doing that is putting him in the slot more, having him run more receiver routes, not using him as sort of this third option in the passing game, but think about how can we feature him in the passing game. Obviously, there's a big hole that's going to be left by Odell Beckham Jr., a guy that could get downfield. Saquon certainly isn't Odell Beckham Jr. as a receiver, but he's pretty darn good. So I think there's definitely some ways to increase the value that he provides the Giants.
And I'll get back to the running game specifically in a second, but I want to stick with the passing game here for a second, because you mentioned, Odell Beckham Jr. not being here. And when I look at the receivers on this roster, you see Golden Tate and Sterling Shepard, very similar in how they're built. And I think the type of route concepts they tend to run. But the other guy I look at, George, is a guy that projects maybe as a potential mismatch that maybe traditionally you don't think of as a downfield threat, but I think the Giants can use him that way. It's a guy like Evan Engram. When you guys look at the analytics on tight ends in terms of being more of a big play guy than a, you know, ball control, third and short type of guy, how do you project Engram in that role, and do you think he does have potential to become that type of mismatch player to help make up for the loss of Odell Beckham Jr.?
Well, all you have to do is look a little further north to see the possible, you know, outcome of having a tight end that can get downfield, right? Rob Gronkowski lapped the field in terms of 20-plus yard gains from the tight end position. I mean, it was just, I think he almost doubled Travis Kelce. I don't have the exact number in front of me, but he was a deep threat for Tom Brady and the Patriots. They utilized him in that way, and of course, he was a physical freak. Evan Engram, maybe he's not Rob Gronkowski necessarily, but he's obviously got some physical tools, and the tight end position is one that is sort of an inefficiency in the NFL. I think it's becoming less so as teams sort of clue in to the ability to put, you know, get them on linebackers and create mismatches. But the tight end position is a very valuable target in the NFL, whether it's from the slot or in line, because you're able to get those mismatches. So I agree with you. I think they need to push that advantage whenever he has a mismatch. The issue that he's had has been drops. So he's made those big plays, but he's also dropped a lot of passes, and that is obviously an easy way to kill value. The good news is that drop rate is not something that's generally very stable among pass catchers. So, you know, he had a bad season. You could certainly have a bounce back in terms of drops. It's a small sample thing. You know, I wouldn't, you know, it's not like Amari Cooper hasn't managed to still be productive after having one of the worst drop seasons that we ever saw. So I think pushing those mismatches, guys that can get downfield don't just have to be outside receivers. You can get guys downfield from the slot. You can get guys downfield from the tight end position or even the running back position. But they're certainly going to have to do so, because without Odell Beckham Jr. on the field over the past five seasons, they have been the worst offense in the NFL, and it's not particularly close. Passing offense is what I mean there. But the worst passing offense in the NFL without Odell Beckham Jr. is not what you want to hear if you're looking at this season being productive.
I'm trying to figure out a good way to go next year, and I guess I'll go here, because I think the last four games of last year, when Odell Beckham was not on the field, the Giants' offense was actually fairly productive. And look, you're never going to be better losing a guy like Beckham, but it looked like in the second half of the year, the Giants did figure something out. They ran a lot more play action on early downs out of big personnel, things like that. Can you talk a little bit about what your research has shown about the impact of a guy like Barkley on play action? Is there a correlation? And just in terms of how play action can generally impact an offense, and whether you think that could be a good path for the Giants to go down this year?
Well, that's a really interesting two-pronged question, because one is one answer is absolutely no, it doesn't matter, and the other answer is absolutely yes, you should do it more.
Right.
There is no evidence out there, and it's been tested by many different people, including us over here at PFF, as to whether, you know, running a lot or running successfully helps you with your play-action game. It's just no evidence that that is the case on a play-by-play level, on a, you know, first half, do I run a lot and then, you know, my play action is successful in the second half. That doesn't happen to be the case.
Hey, George, real fast. Is there an inverse relationship? Does running poorly adversely affect the play action, or is there no relationship at all?
No, there's just... There's no correlation, right? It's just like, what matters for your passing game? Well, probably matters whether your quarterback's good, whether pass... Really, what matters in play action, and we saw this with the Rams, I think, quite a bit, was... Can you set up the blocks, right? Can you pass block? Because play action takes longer to develop. And really what the Rams sort of tried to do with it was use play action to create clean pockets for Jared Goff. And when some of those tackles started losing, it really caused some problems for him. So those are the things that really matter in the play action game. And the idea that you have to set up play action by running the ball is just not the case, and probably in large part because the run game has just been set up and established by years and years of beating into people's brains that you've got to run the ball and stop the run, right? So defenses come out and they're amped to stop the run, and then they stop the run and they're even more excited to stop it again because they're pumped up. So it's a self-perpetuating thing, and I think that actually happens for offenses too. So I think if we saw this with the Cowboys, actually. It was really interesting. When they didn't have Zeke on the field, they ran an amazingly low amount of play action. It was like the lowest rate in the league, I think, other than the Steelers without Zeke on the field.
Wow.
And they were terrible at it. But they actually weren't a worse offense overall. So they stopped doing something that generally is more efficient, play action. And they were bad at it. But they managed to be just as good of an offense, with random running backs like Rod Smith and Darren McFadden and Alfred Morris on the field, which I think speaks to the idea that you really don't want to believe all the things you hear, because it might actually impact the way you play the game and the way you call plays, because the play-action game is something that is really efficient, and it should be done a lot more. We saw the Rams push 40% play-action rates through about, 13 weeks last season, and they were amazing at it. So I would certainly run play-action more. I think that'd be something that if you're a Giants team with a guy like Daniel Jones eventually taking the reins, he's got some mobility back there. I would focus on a really heavy play action system, allow guys like Evan Ingram to get across the field, guys like Golden Tate to get across the field, Saquon Barkley to get across the field and create some space.
Yeah.
A la what the Rams did, right? And then give them some room to make some plays and, take advantage of, I think what, Daniel Jones has at least shown bits and pieces of, which is that he avoids some of those, negative plays. And he's obviously at Duke had success throwing short. So, you open up some of those lanes and make some plays available.
Is there an impact on an offense, either in the run game or pass game? Is there any correlation based on what the defense is doing in terms of guys in the box, single high, two high, crowding the line of scrimmage? Is there a pattern where that either adversely affects a run game, helps an opposing passing game? Have you guys been able to study any of that?
Oh, that's, I was going to say, I talk about the offensive side of the ball in terms of, predicting rushing success. But that is, the defensive personnel, which a lot of it is kind of matching what the offense brings out there.
Of course.
Is basically the reason that matters, right? So when we talk about, you want to run the ball at a pass set. Why is that? Well, it's because when you show up in a pass set, the defense matches with, a passing personnel group, and so they don't have nine guys in the box. So you want box count is the thing that can basically tell you whether you should run in certain situations or not, far more than whether you believe your running back is generational or not. So you hit the nail on the head there. When you're thinking about running the ball, I think the NFL has largely had it backwards for a while. What you want to do is run the ball in short yardage situations, but you want to do so against non-crowded boxes. So you want to spread them out to run the ball in those short yardage situations. That is the place where running is more effective than passing. It's not second and long. It's not first down. Those are not the places that you want to run the ball. But yet, that's when the NFL thinks you've got to run to stay on schedule.
This is going to be a very broad question, so you could take it any direction you want. You mentioned in terms of play action, you need an effective offensive line to pull it off, because a lot of times those are slower developing plays. Guys are dragging across the field, stuff like that. We know how offensive line play affects the running game. Just in general, when you take a look at all your analytics, how important is consistently good offensive line play, or maybe even just not having a poor offensive line, to the overall efficiency of an offense in the National Football League?
A great question. One of the things that is really interesting is you can get by with an average offensive line. That's not an issue. It's the brutally bad offensive line or offensive linemen that can torpedo things. So going from great to average, that's not a huge deal. A lot of pressure rate is owned by the quarterback. How well do they get to their first read? Do they kind of understand when the blitz is coming, things like that. So pressure rate is actually more stable from quarterback to quarterback than it is from offensive line to offensive line, which I think is interesting.
Interesting.
And tells us a lot about the importance of the offensive line. And then there's, of course, the scheme, right? So it almost goes both ways. And the Rams, again, are a really good example of this. They sort of hid some of their deficiencies at the offensive line position with this really effective play-action scheme where they really sold the outside zone and gave their guys a split second more, gave Jared Goff a split second more to sit back there in a clean pocket. That's why Jared Goff averaged more time in a clean pocket per dropback than any other quarterback, and he was abysmal, as are most quarterbacks under pressure. So that's super valuable. So I would think of it more like this. I want to avoid having a thin offensive line because an injury is going to happen on the offensive line. That's just a fact. And I really don't want to, you know, overpay that, you know, left or right tackle who I don't really feel strongly about, because then you've allocated a lot of that capital and you need those five guys. You can't have just one guy be really solid. You need them all. You need that continuity, as you said, because one really bad offensive lineman is what hurts you. Average across the line does not.
The passing game, and this is another broad question. Better for an offense overall to have a shorter, more efficient pass game, or to be an offense that constantly and consistently tries to challenge down the field for big plays?
It's what your quarterback does best. You know, if you are, what's a good example of this? I think if you're the Carolina Panthers, right? The idea that Cam Newton needs to be better throwing, you know, checkdowns to his to Christian McCaffrey, needs to be more accurate doing that. Yeah, sure. But what he does is he makes big plays. So give him chances to make big plays.
Got it.
Jameis Winston is another guy, right? But if you've got a Drew Brees back there who is so lethally accurate on those short passes, then do that, right? Scheme open those short, quick throws, let him be incredibly accurate, and let his receivers make plays after the catch. And if you're a guy that, you know, that's not your forte, throw it downfield and let your receivers make plays you know, at the catch point. I think it's sort of a misnomer that, you know, look at Andy Reid in Kansas City. Look at how different that offense was with Alex Smith and then with Pat Mahomes.
Yeah, good point.
But they were both top five offenses. Now, Pat Mahomes is better than Alex Smith, and he's really good throwing, you know, those short, clean pocket throws, which I think people sort of sweep under the rug. So they were better with Pat Mahomes. But Alex Smith led the league in passer rating with the Chiefs. So, you know, you can do it both ways. It's just a matter of maximizing what your quarterback has to offer.
Well, you just mentioned about underrating a quarterback's ability to make those easy, what people think are easy passes out of a clean pocket. What are some of the things you found in predicting and analyzing quarterback performance that are the most important things a quarterback needs to do well if he's going to be an effective top 10 quarterback that can lead a top offense in the league?
It's exactly that, right? So what I always start off with is I ask people, what is the most common situation that a quarterback finds himself in? And even if you have a terrible offensive line, right? So think about the Cardinals last year. Josh Rosen under pressure about 40% of the time, maybe a little bit more. Most quick pressures in the entire NFL given up. But he was still in a clean pocket more often than he was in a pressured pocket. And so how you perform from a clean pocket is an incredibly stable component of quarterback play. Whereas in a pressured pocket, things are not, you know, very normal, right? All pressures are sort of unique, like snowflakes. Whereas clean pockets, you by and large kind of know what they look like. And so clean pocket play, performance from a clean pocket, is one of those things. It's not particularly sexy, right? A lot of those plays, you know, you're able to hit your first read. It sort of seems like, hey, anybody could do it. But that's not the case, right? If anyone could do it, then you'd have a heck of a lot more quarterbacks going from college to the pros and being successful. But you see guys who just, they are not able to be accurate on short, open throws. And that is a real kind of derailer of an offense, right? Because those are the plays that happen the most frequently. And so you need to be able to hit them. And that, I think, gets me to the biggest, most stable component of quarterback play, which is avoiding what we call negatively graded plays. So from a throwing perspective, imagine a quarterback has a guy that's open, you know, 8 yards downfield, and he throws a pass that is uncatchable, right? That is, you can't have that because you don't give yourself a chance on that play. So the quarterbacks that minimize those mistakes, right, that totally derail a potential positive game, those are the most, that's the most valuable component of quarterback play. So guys like Drew Brees, Pat Mahomes, Tom Brady, Aaron Rodgers, not as much last year, but in his really good years, always consistently at the top of the list in terms of avoiding negative related plays, and it is the most stable component of quarterback play. So when you're looking at whether a guy's coming from college to pro or just from year to year at the pro level, I want to look at how did he perform from a clean pocket and how well did he avoid those negatively graded plays, those uncatchable passes, taking bad sacks, allowing strip sack fumbles, stuff like that. Those plays that just give you no shot at gaining positive yardage or positive expected points.
And I think this brings us back to one of the, I'll call it a big revelation you guys had in a lot of your data research this year, that you think in a lot of ways coverage is more important than pass rush when determining the effectiveness as a defense. So why don't you tell the fans a little bit how you guys came to that conclusion and why you think that's the case?
Well, this is a hot button topic, and so I want to rephrase what you said.
Okay.
I didn't think that. We had no idea.
Right.
This was a question that we had, and this gets at something a little bit bigger, which is the kind of disconnect between football minds and people that live on spreadsheets. Even though I avoid spreadsheets like the plague, but it's the idea that I had this original idea that was totally different than what you thought because you're an idiot and you couldn't possibly know because you didn't take Calc 2 in high school. That's a ridiculous statement. Really, no one knows a whole lot of anything, and you've got to go test these conjectures and see what you find out.
100%.
And I would be lying if I told you, I went into it and I just knew. I knew the running game didn't matter. I knew it didn't set up play action. I knew that pass coverage was more valuable than pass rush. I didn't. But you have to be open-minded, and when the numbers tell you something that is counterintuitive, you've got to check them, obviously, make sure that you've done everything soundly, but then you've got to be willing to change what you believe. So when we went into this study, and we're uniquely lucky to have grading at a play-by-play and player-by-player and facet-by-facet level to sort of look at how well players performed as pass rushers and in coverage, because the box score can obviously, it does gloss over that. And so we were able to say, what is a better predictor of winning? What is a better predictor of defensive success? Being a good pass rush team or being a good coverage team. And it really isn't particularly close. Coverage just does such a better job of predicting defensive success going forward, whether it be week to week or season to season, than pass rush does. Teams that were in the top 25% in terms of coverage grade, but in the bottom 25% in pass rush grade, won two more games on average than the inverse. In other words, the team being really good at pass rush but not good at coverage. That's kind of a high-level way of thinking about why the evidence that pass rush is not as important. And it was honestly surprising because when we watch the game of football, what do we see? We see the quarterback and we see what happens around him, and that's the pass rushers. And we don't even see the coverage, unless there's, a target. So we obviously, there's all those other guys on the field that obviously matter. And unless it's a real innovative, producer of the football podcast, like what we see on Sunday Night Football, where they have that coverage sack, where they show you all the coverages on the field, that doesn't happen that often. And that, I think, is a big reason why just in our minds, pass rush feels like it's more valuable, the sack, the fumbles, or big plays. But the coverage players are always on the opposite end of the most valuable play in football, and that's the forward pass. And they are, no matter whether the pass rush gets to the quarterback or not, on about, sacks don't happen that often, right?
Yeah.
So whenever there's a throw, right, it's the coverage that is on the other end of that. Pressure only happens a little over 30% of the time. So you've got 70% of these plays where a quarterback is in a clean pocket. That's on the coverage guy, right? You cannot lose in coverage. You're going to give up huge plays in the NFL today. It makes sense once you start to break it down, but it's certainly not intuitive.
All right, I got some big picture questions here that I'm curious in terms of if or not you guys have found any data on them yet. Let's start here. You talk about the benefit of passing on first down and stuff like that. Are we going to get to a point, George, or is there a threshold in terms of run-pass splits and percentage where teams are going to get that out of their head to automatically have the first thing in their mind, I need to stop the run on first down, where first down passing and even play-action becomes somewhat less effective? What do you think the threshold there is for run-pass splits where teams eventually stop thinking the way they do on the defensive side of the ball?
Well, I would like to find out. I would push that threshold as far as I could. I think, you know, what talking to some, you know, people that have played the position, a guy who now coaches at the with Sean McVay in Los Angeles, Zach Robinson, who worked with us for multiple years and was kind of a pioneer of a lot of the things that we do from a ball location charting perspective with quarterbacks, talks a lot about the, you know, mental and physical components of quarterback play in the passing game. And, you know, the run game kind of serves as a mental and physical break for the quarterback. And so I think that is an important component of it. So thinking about what the threshold is for your quarterback is important. And then what I would do is say, okay, this is the number of, you know, this is the number of maximum number of dropbacks I can have for my quarterback. Where can I, you know, service those breaks essentially? And so I would look at the places where the run is the most effective. Basically third and fourth and short. And that's where I'm running the ball. And then I'm looking at situations, you know, that's obviously not going to take care of probably all of the breaks I need. And so then I'm looking at, you know, whether it be first and 10 or second and medium, what are the defensive components that I need in order to give me the advantage necessary to run? So we talked about those light boxes, right?
Yeah.
Lining up in pass sets to run the ball. But I am maximizing. I am pushing that limit because, as we saw last year, passing became more prevalent, but it was also more successful. So we haven't seen that. We haven't come close. Maybe a little bit, hopeful. But I don't. You know, we certainly haven't seen the threshold of maximizing passing offenses. Certainly not with play action yet. I think there. You know, there's more young coaches coming into the NFL that are more willing to, you know, I think experiment and try some new things. But I would push that limit, man, because we haven't found it yet.
Yeah, and it's funny. I think this brings me to my next question, which is taking your overall league-wide trends and statistics and patterns and things like that and the data you measure, and then you have to apply it to individual games with individual players, the individual talents, and individual matchups against the team that you're playing. So I guess from a team perspective, and I think we saw, was it the playoff game last year when the Chargers went all DBs with no linebackers and the Patriots ran for like 800 yards on them? I think that was the game, if I remember right. I guess that's a situation where you have to take the data, right, but then you also have to adjust it to the matchups and the schemes that the individual coaches are putting on the field on an individual game-to-game basis.
Absolutely. That's what the Patriots always do best. They find your weak point and they annihilate it, right? That's a lot of teams are not. I think the Super Bowl was a really good example of this. The Rams did a great job of winning in the regular season. They reminded me a lot of the Houston Rockets.
Okay.
The Houston Rockets came out there on a night-to-night basis and they shot, you know, 63s a game. They did the same thing on offense every time, right? But it was really effective because on a night-to-night basis, on a week-to-week basis, preparing for the Rams is really hard because you only have a few days and they have enough multiplicity in their offense that you just aren't quite sure what's coming. But the Super Bowl comes around and you've got Bill Belichick and he's got 2 weeks to sit there and learn everything about your offense. And when you come out there and try to do the same things, at some point, right, when you have enough time to prepare, you're not quite able to have that same success. The Patriots, you never quite know, because what they go do is they go look at your weakness. They find ways to make sure that your weakness is exposed to them, and then they attack it. And they're able to make those on the fly, which we saw in the Super Bowl, right? They come out in 22 in that fourth quarter drive that ultimately won the game for
yep.
them, sealed the deal. They went 22 and went five wide. It was four or five straight plays. That had been done like three times in the NFL up to that point. And they just knew, look, if we come out in this heavy set, the Rams are going to match. If they get poor Samson Ebukam trying to cover Gronk on a, you know, wheel, they've got linebackers split out trying to cover guys, you know, in the passing game. And that ability to find the weakness, whether it's in the passing game or in the running game, is what allows the Patriots to kind of dominate, you know, week in and week out. So I think you hit the nail on the head, right? It's also about being able to prepare in a way that is opponent specific, as opposed to just having, you know, a global tenet that you always blindly follow. I will caveat it with, you can't just throw the efficiency out the window, right?
Of course.
Because the large samples do matter, and, you know, passing is still going to be, you know, by and large, in almost every case, more efficient than running, but you find the ways to take advantage of when you have to run for whatever reason, or when running all of a sudden becomes more valuable, and you don't miss those opportunities, right? Because that's when you want to make sure that you're making the plus expected value proposition on every play that you can.
Turnovers. There might not be a better predictor of who wins a football game than turnovers. The problem is that, in my experience and what I've looked at, and maybe you can correct me because you look at more data than I do, turnovers are hard to predict. They're not very predictive year to year. Teams can be in the top of the list 1 year, bottom of the list the next year with the same coach and the same players. So when you take a look at turnovers, have you been able to figure out, is there a way to predict them? Can teams control takeaways, or is it a lot easier to control your own mistakes on offense? Are turnovers more dependent on the offense making mistakes or the defense making a great play? Because it's so important to winning football games. It changes games on a whim. What have you been able to learn about turnovers, predicting them, and how you either get them or prevent them at the NFL level?
Well, we talked about those negatively graded plays earlier, right? And
yeah.
Those being very predictive. And there's another sort of level of negative, which is what we call turnover worthy. So those are passes that are so bad that they're intercepted 50%+ of the time. But think about that for a second, just above 50%+. So interceptions, even on passes that are just right to defenders, it's a crapshoot, right? Just, you know, flip a coin. So from a turnover perspective, the result is far harder to predict using prior results than prior process. So what I mean by that is, like, if I'm trying to predict interceptions in a season for a quarterback, first off, I'm not going to be able to do it very well, but I'm better off using the number of throws he made that had a 50%+ chance of being intercepted, those turnover-worthy throws, than I am how many interceptions he actually had the season
right
before. Either way, I'm going to have very little confidence in the number of actual interceptions the guy has for that exact reason. It's just so much variance. So from a prediction standpoint, that's something that goes in that luck bucket, right? I'm not going to worry about, you know, preaching about turnovers. I'm going to preach the process that, as a side effect, will, you know, hopefully avoid turnovers because they're very bad. But there are things that I can actually control and preach, which is, hey, let's not have these negative throws, right? Let's preach the importance of being accurate in all situations, not always looking for the hero throw, you know, taking what's available, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Versus saying, hey, we've got to win the turnover battle, because largely that's just not something players can control. And, you know, that can have a negative effect, I think, psychologically, right? Because players want to see themselves able to control things that they're doing on the field. So turnovers are one of those things that's important but unpredictable, and so it's basically variance. And that's a huge reason why defensive success from season to season is not stable. It's not consistent. The Bears were the best defense in the NFL last year, and it wasn't even close. Well, the reason for that is they converted the highest number of their turnover-worthy opportunities into turnovers. About 7% of turnover-worthy throws they picked off. I mentioned that the league average is just above 50. But the season before, they led the league and dropped interceptions. So, you know, it's one of those things where it's great to have when it's happening, but it's not something that you necessarily want to bank on from season to season. I would focus more on, if I'm a defensive coordinator, I'm trying to plan a defense, I'm worried more about not getting, you know, beaten in coverage than forcing turnovers. And I think ultimately, you know, the turnovers will swing back and forth, but that consistency that you have in coverage is something that's at least a little bit more controllable from a player standpoint.
Well, you just made me very happy, because that basically is anecdotally what I've been telling people about takeaways and turnovers, is that you can't depend on them. If they come, they're great, but it's something you can't really depend on year to year. We've kind of touched on this throughout the podcast, George, but I'll ask it to you anyway. Impact on player quality versus coaching. Because I think a lot of times the answer fans don't want to hear when they call up and ask why their team's bad, and you say the players just aren't good enough. And I think you can have any level of coaching. If you don't have good players, it's just not going to work. How are you able to measure, you know, the importance of the quality of the coaching, the scheme, things like that, and versus player quality in terms of teams winning football games?
Well, that is something that I don't think we're necessarily as close to answering as some of the other questions, but it's something that we're really trying to work on. So we do have a way that we measure what we call like coaching decisions and coaching kind of scheme or play calling. And essentially what we're looking at is, if I were to just try and predict how efficient a play with this set of players that are on the field or that this team has would be against whatever the defense is, well, the value that's sort of added to that, right, is something that we like to attribute to the coach, right? So if it's like, you know, I have this kind of average quarterback, some average receivers, but this team is a top 10 offense, well, we're going to give that credit to the coach. So that's the way that we model it currently. We're doing a lot more with passing schemes at the moment, actually, with quantifying exactly what concepts teams are running, which ones are the most successful, which areas of the field are passing concepts targeting, which ones should they be targeting. So hopefully we'll have some kind of deeper insights into that soon. But I think it's, you know, the situation that a player ends up in is very important, right, from a quarterback perspective. Particularly, we see this all the time. And there's certainly a lot that a coach can do to maximize those things that are efficient for quarterbacks. But there's a limit to that, obviously, right? If you just don't have players that can block or catch or throw, coach can't do that. You know, but you look at a guy like Sean McVay, the guy is as close to being a player on the field as you can get, right? Up until that mic cuts off, he's reading the defense. He's telling Jared Goff what to do. He's running the most play action in the NFL. He's got, you know, guys running scot-free over the middle of the field as much as anyone else. And Jared Goff went from being a complete bust with, you know, Jeff Fisher dropping 25 yards back on straight drops and, you know, hoping and praying to now an MVP candidate through, you know, what, like 15 weeks of the season last year.
You mentioned the middle of the field. Your data has shown that throwing to the middle of the field is generally more efficient than the sideline. And I guess my question for you, does that really impress upon teams the importance of having safeties and linebackers and slot corners that can defend that middle of the field well?
I think you hit the nail on the head there. The big inefficiency from a sort of like offensive scheme perspective, I think, is finding those guys that can't cover, getting them on the field, and having an offensive guy, you know, a tight end, a running back that can run routes down the field. Linebackers and safeties and cut in primary coverage are just not as good as corners. That's a fact, particularly linebackers. So when you're looking at what makes a good linebacker, what makes a good safety, I look at two guys. I look at, well, maybe three. I got to put Bobby Wagner in there. But I also look at Deion Jones. I look at Derwin James. Those are guys that can match up against tight ends. I think Derwin James, a lot of pass rating sub 40 when matched up against a tight end. I mean, it was a joke. And that is what I'm looking for if I'm trying to find safeties and linebackers. Can they cover? Because, you know, as I spoke about before, and as the data, you know, all the research that has been done kind of across the analytics world has shown, the run game is just not something, and run defense for that matter, is just not something that helps you win football games. So it's all about being able to cover. And you're right. I mean, that middle of the field, 10-plus yards downfield, from a yards per target perspective, it's not even close. That is the area of the field that generates the most yards per throw. It does have more, you know, there are more unlucky interceptions, so I think that's some of the reason that maybe less confident quarterbacks don't throw into that area as much, so defenses get a little lucky there. But the good quarterbacks, the Tom Brady's, the Drew Brees's, the Aaron Rodgers prior to last season, have always torched that area of the field, and that's why they end up winning MVPs and Super Bowls.
The reason that running does not help a team win games as much as the passing game, does that just boil down, George, basically to yards per play?
I think that's a great way of putting it. The way that I would, if I were to get a little bit deeper, I would say you could contextualize yards per play, right? Because like 5 yards on third and 10 isn't really worth a whole lot, but 5 yards on like third and 4 obviously matters.
Of course.
So when we add that context to it and we look at how much closer to scoring does a pass play or a run play get you in all of these different situations, you know, first and 10, second and long, second and medium, second and short, third and long, all these different permutations, the pass game is far more efficient, and it's in general not even close. So the average run play is actually getting you further away from scoring, which is kind of hard to imagine. But you asked, I think, a great question the last time we spoke, which is, you know, what does like a 4-yard run on first and 10 do for you?
Yeah, I remember that.
Like,
that's right.
People, I thought that was one of the best questions that I've ever heard, and I've used that multiple times since then. I think a lot of people would say, it keeps me on schedule. It doesn't. And that is, I think, a hurdle for people to get over, but it boils down to the passing game on average gets you closer to scoring in almost every situation, whereas the run game does not.
And I think you boiled it down, George. In order for the run game to be more efficient, to make it well worth it on a first down play, you have to get 5 or 6 yards. Is that pretty much what the data shows you?
Yeah, I mean, in most situations, it's 6. You know, so
wow.
The NFL is you know, football is like a very simple game, you know, fundamentally, but there are so many kind of nooks and crannies that I think are just not intuitive to people that hopefully will make the game more exciting, right? Because what we're talking about are things that ultimately offenses score more points, which everyone likes to see.
Does that include?
Or I think everyone likes to see. There might be some people out there that still really love what we saw in the Super Bowl, but the Super Bowl was a fun game, but I would have preferred a few more points, I think.
Do those calculations include, by the way, the dangers inherent in the passing game, whether it's losing big yards in a sack, potentially throwing an interception, where I think there probably is a little bit more risk involved in passing the ball than it is in running the ball, right?
Well, so again, I think that's the intuitive thought. And yes, those are included, right? So like an interception is a terrible play. But you know what else is a terrible play? Holding on outside zone on second and long.
That's a good point.
That's a terrible play. Because, you know, people like to talk about sacks way too much. I mean, they're valuable, but they're very hard to predict. But there are negative plays inherent with the run game that also get glossed over, and holding is certainly one of them. It's one of the reasons that outside zone runs are, you know, I wouldn't run them so much, because holding is a terrible play, particularly when you run on a down with, you know, where it's less advantageous to run the ball, because you're really, those are those longer down and distances. And so, you know, you think about it from a second and long perspective, that's torpedoing that drive. It's almost, you know, it's so hard for you to come back from that. And you're obviously only going to come back from it with a strong passing game.
Now, the Giants are playing a lot of young guys this year, George. I know you guys have tracked well what grades from college project well to the NFL. Generally, the closer you get to the ball, the better those grades are going to project. Have you guys looked at all about what positions coming out of college struggle more early in the National Football League? And I'm asking specifically about the cornerback position, because the Giants are going to roll out a bunch of young cornerbacks that haven't really played a whole lot, and whether or not you guys have any sort of data on what collegiate players struggle more so than others early on in their NFL careers.
Yeah, my collaborator Eric Eager has done a lot of work on this college to pro projection, and something that we are actively trying to get better at, because it's a $1 million question.
Oh, right? It really is.
You know, that is where money is made in the NFL. You become a great team, a Super Bowl contender, by drafting a lot and you know, not making errors in drafting. And so there are a couple things that I think you can take advantage of. We spoke about how coverage is more valuable than pass rush, but it's also harder to predict. So as you mentioned, we feel very is maybe a little strong, but we feel far more confident about pass rushers projecting from college to pro than we do about coverage players. Now, I think we'll get better at that, because we're building in nuance that I think is inherent in the coverage game. But the sort of inefficiency there that you can take advantage of is, well, if I'm better at projecting pass rushers, but I know coverage is really important, I've got to take chances in coverage, right, early and often. And then I can find guys, this is something that Eric also talks a lot about, I can find guys later in the draft that can be productive pass rushers, right? I can also find guys, the Patriots always do this, bargain basement, they're probably going to do it again this year, bargain basement pass rushers that can be stable pass rushers. But where you have to take shots, because it's so important, is in coverage, is a defensive back. So, look, the Giants may, you know, they may miss on a few of these guys, but they've got to take chances in coverage, because if you don't have a strong coverage, it does not matter how good your pass rush is, right? The Eagles have had a great defensive line for a while. They win the Super Bowl after that coverage becomes solidified, you know, going from bottom half of the league team to a top half of the league team. It's just so vital. So instead of just throwing your hands up and saying, well, I can't predict it, so I'm not going to try, you actually want to look at where it's harder to predict but still valuable, and then take those shots.
Now, we've all heard about WAR and VORP in baseball. It's been very popular. People have used it a long time. You guys are trying to develop it in football. Where are you guys at with that? How have you gone about trying to put those numbers together and explain to fans what it is?
Yeah, so wins above replacement is something that's used, obviously, a lot in baseball. And baseball is a lot easier to handle because, look, you're either a batter or a pitcher, and all batters and pitchers do the same thing. But in football, it's just everyone is doing something different. There's so many phases of the game, and it's so hard to say how valuable with box score statistics. Let me actually rephrase that. It currently, up until PFF came around, had been impossible to say really how well a player did his job in all of those facets, right? The O line, the D line, team coverage. And so once we had that ability to better quantify, and not, we're not perfect, but we do a pretty good job. You can look at the stability of our grades and how well they predict wins, and that's a litmus test of whether we're doing a good job grading or not. You can then say, okay, I know how well a player performed his job, and then we can use math and machine learning to say how valuable is doing that well in that facet, and that allows us to put both of those pieces together and say, okay, over a replacement level player, how valuable was this player? And so it's a huge step, because what it does is it's cross-positional. Before this, you would look at Aaron Donald and Pat Mahomes. They both played at a tremendous level. They're fantastic. And you might be able to have a debate, maybe, about which one's more valuable. But now with this, we can say for sure, like definitively, this is how much more valuable Pat Mahomes is than Aaron Donald. This is how much more valuable a tackle is than a guard. This is how much more valuable the passing game is than the running game, those types of things. So it's very exciting. I'm looking forward to publishing a lot of the work that we've done on that in a more formal format soon. It is the most stable, and what I mean by stable is consistent in terms of from season to season. Players with high WAR are going to have high WAR the next season, and with low WAR, they're going to be bad the next season. It's the most stable metric that we have yet tested in our time here as a research and development department at PFF.
All right, George, final question. I'm going to open the floor to you. Give me something either that you're working on that you think is interesting that people don't know about, or something that we haven't touched on that you hear people say often on television or radio when talking about the NFL that makes you want to slam your head into the wall.
Wow. Well, we certainly hit the rushing attempts are all that matter bit over the head. So I will not say that one. There's a lot of great work that's being done here. We just hired a couple of new people onto our team, Kevin Cole and a guy named over in Germany named Timo Riske. And they are working on some really innovative stuff I mentioned the passing concept stuff, so actually leveraging all the routes that are run on the field.
Wow.
To get a sense of where the passing concept is most likely to target. And so we can then look at like where that scheme expects, to throw the ball, and there's a lot of ramifications there. And then also linking WAR and contract information to give a better decision-making tool for how much should I pay a player, whether it be in free agency or, extending a player and whatnot. So those are a couple of things that we're working on. And then the other huge thing that we touched briefly was college to pro, right? Cracking that open is just going to be massive. And so it's something that we're working on a lot that Eric, as I mentioned, has put a lot of work into. And he's a brilliant guy, so I'm very excited about the success he's going to have.
George, tell people where they can find all the Pro Football Focus stuff, how they subscribe, or what kind of packages you got, and just in terms of how people find all your great work.
Thank you. So if you go to PFF now, not Pro Football Focus, PFF.com is where you can subscribe to all the great stuff. The analytics podcast is the PFF Forecast. I am, as usual, very annoying and sarcastic, but Eric, my co-host, often drops quite a bit of good knowledge. So if you can get past me, you'll probably enjoy it quite a bit. And you can find us on Twitter, obviously, at PFF. I'm at PFF_George, and then at PFF_Eric. And then, you know, you'll find everyone else from there, I think.
By the way, our analytics guy, John Berger, sends his regards. He wanted me to say hi, and we really appreciate the time, George. Great stuff. I know we went a little bit longer than we thought, but I thought it was a great conversation. I hope you had fun. I know I did, and we'll talk to you down the road. All right, pal?
Always have fun, man. Give John my best. John, like you, good people.
I appreciate it, George. Good stuff, man. Have fun. The grind's about to, well, I guess, ratchet it up, not begin.
We are in full grind mode over here.
Thanks, brother. That's George Shiruri. Does an excellent job for Pro Football Focus, all the analytics, a lot of the data. And again, folks, this is stuff that a lot of people start learning things about. And, you know, there are larger themes like we talked about, but there are specific things game to game with matchups and teams that do change as you move along with these analytics. And teams try to take the data. And the trick is taking this data information and then turning it into something that's actionable for NFL teams. And I think that's a good thing that Pro Football Focus is trying to do. And it's difficult because, you know, it's not an individual game like baseball. It's a team game where every player on the field affects everyone else. And this is a very difficult thing to handle. Well, folks, I know it's a longer podcast than usual, but I thought it was great. I thought it was informational. I hope you enjoyed it. I know I did. I get into all the stuff. I hope we all learned something from George over at Pro Football Focus. Want to remind you very quickly, if you're on Giants.com, the Giants mobile app, that's great listening to this, but go to your favorite podcast platform, subscribe, and make us part of your favorites, make us part of your feed. If you're on Apple Podcasts or iTunes, make sure you leave a positive review. For George Shahruri, I am John Schmelk. We'll see you next time on the Giants Huddle Podcast. Adios.